Welcome to this Tuesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, in Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Ezern explores the Homestead Act, which is often portrayed as a failed experiment, but new scholarship, he says, tells a different story. And tough times on the farm. Is today's downturn another 80s crisis? But we begin today with a true North Dakota story from 1907, when a young railroad worker returned home and was murdered. History doesn't always begin in an archive. Sometimes it begins with a gravestone. As a boy visiting relatives in Nitshe, North Dakota, Bill Tronset wandered into a local cemetery and stopped in front of a headstone that didn't read "died." It read "murdered." His grandmother, a local historian, responded by bringing out newspaper accounts from 1907 chronicling the death of a young railroad worker named Arthur LeClaire. That afternoon sparked a fascination that stayed with Bill for nearly 50 years. The result is a new book, A Murder for Christmas. While inspired by the real murder, the novel is much more than a mystery. It's a vivid portrait of northeastern North Dakota at the beginning of the 20th century. It's railroad towns, immigrant families, churches, hotels, customs houses, and prairie communities. It's also a story about memory, how history survives because ordinary people choose to remember it. Bill joins us today to talk about the real crime that inspired the novel, the years of research behind it, and why some North Dakota stories deserve to be told. Bill, welcome to Main Street.
Glad to be here, Craig. Thank you.
I am really pleased that you are with us today. You've said that this book really started with a gravestone in the Nitshe Cemetery. Can you take us back to that day and explain why that moment has stayed for you for such a long period of time?
My parents used to send me up to stay with my grandma and grandpa for a week or so, some summers. And this particular summer, I think I was 10. You know, I was a bored kid at times. There weren't a lot of other kids my age around. So I would wander around, ride a bike, walk. And I walked around town and I ended up just in the Catholic cemetery in Nitshe. And I started to look at the gravestones and I walked along. And then I saw this one that was, you know, probably taller than me. And it said Arthur LeClaire, born April 1st, I think 1889. And then just right there in big letters, murdered December 22nd, 1907. So I walked back to my grandma's house and told her about it. And now she had a cellar full of stuff. She wouldn't let us down there, but she went down and came up with some yellow old newspapers that her mother had saved and then some that she had saved. She was born in 1908, so it was, you know, she didn't save them when she was born, but her mom did.
That's one of the amazing parts of the story to me, is that she could go downstairs, find what you were asking about, and bring those old newspaper clippings to you. Do you think she realized back then that she was passing along maybe just a little bit more than local history?
I think so, because, well, she was a local historian. She was part of the Pembina Historical Society. And she had, in, I think, 1976, participated in writing a book, Proudly We Speak. It's a two-part series on the area, and it has the history of the settling of Nitshe, Bathgate, and I think Hyde Park, which I didn't even know was a town. And she knew I was interested, and later she gave me those books. Those were the only two she had. So I think she was, you know, trying to pass something down to me.
So you saw the headstone, you saw the word murdered, you had these newspaper clips, but something about Arthur LeClaire's story refused to let go of you over the years. What was that?
Well, part of it was just Nitshe and thinking about the town and being, you know, like remembering that day. I went to school in Grand Forks with a kid named LeClaire, so that kept the memory going for me, and I think he was probably related. And then, you know, in the 90s, I was living in California, and I decided, I think I'm going to write a story or a book about it. So I wrote a letter to my grandma, you know, on paper like we used to do, and asked her for, you know, copies of those news articles. And a couple of months later, I got a manila envelope full of copies. They were actually handwritten copies. Wow. She sat there at her kitchen table, and I don't think she really knew what a copy machine was, or she didn't have one, or she just copied them all by hand. And then I felt like, you know, now I kind of am obligated to do it. She took all the time to do that. Now we have like the Library of Congress, so I could go back and find all those articles in newsprint, a little bit easier to read. She had good handwriting, but it's cursive from the olden days.
So readers, I think, might expect a murder mystery here, but I think what they actually find is just an incredibly detailed portrait of life in North Dakota, in northeastern North Dakota in 1907. Was that the book you intended to write?
Well, as I had done research over the years, yes, but not originally. Originally, it was just to tell the story about the murder. But then I needed to put it in context and, you know, to know what it was like to be alive in Nietzsche in 1907. And I was really surprised, actually, because the diversity of people there, you know, there were Ukrainians who came mostly to the Canadian side, you know, to build Gretna, which is right across the river from Nietzsche. And the guy who built the hotel, whose son is a key part of the book, he was from London, England. So I didn't realize it was sort of like almost like a gold rush, but for wheat, you know. And the railroads had just gone in, and they had a way of getting the wheat back to England and Europe. And that was a big part of what, you know, ordinary people ate back then is bread, you know, maybe only bread. And so it was a big discovery for me, and I had a great time learning about it.
I found myself thinking that Nietzsche was almost a central character in your book. And you spoke about kind of preserving the town and its way of life. It's almost, to me, as important as the story of telling about the murder.
Yeah, Nietzsche has a special place in my heart. You know, my grandparents are from there, and I have my cousins there. And I just have a fondness for the town. You know, and I always have. So I wanted to try and do it justice. And, you know, it, just like all the other small towns in North Dakota, it's struggled and times have changed. And, you know, it has less than half the population now that it did back in 1907. But it's still a real town. There's people there. And, you know, I love going back there. I don't get to go very much anymore. But, yeah, Nietzsche is a very important part of the book, and because it's important to me.
Before the crime occurs, you spend a considerable amount of time introducing readers to Arthur LeClaire, his family and the railroad, the O'Brien Hotel, and as we've talked about, everyday life in the community. How do you make that bridge between fiction and nonfiction in this case, but yet still stay true to the story that you want to tell?
Well, I had to make up a lot of it. The part that made it a little bit easier, of course, is there is a historical record and there are newspaper articles. And obviously you can learn about the railroad and you can learn about all kinds of things, that who built the depot in Grand Forks and where, you know, Robert Griffith's store was. So with that sort of framework, then I filled in, you know, what I thought were the interior parts of people's lives.
I'm enjoying my conversation with Bill Tronsett. He joins us today to talk about the real crime that inspired the novel that he's just written, the years of research behind it, and why some North Dakota stories deserve to be told. The book is titled A Murder for Christmas. Arthur LeClaire immediately comes across as a thoughtful young man right away. He's saving money to surprise his parents for Christmas Why was it so important for you to establish who he was before readers ever think of him as a murder victim?
Well, that was my core memory of it. So when I told my grandma about it, she told me about the two $50 bills under the plate. And that's not something I saw in any newspaper article. I did see that he was bringing money back as a gift. But so that's kind of, you know, the core memory that everything sprouted from.
What surprised you most about everyday life at that time around the North Dakota-Canadian border at the turn of the 20th century?
You know, they didn't have cars. They didn't have telephones. They had each other. And I guess what surprised, it's not so much of a surprise because I remember my grandparents, but the way people, you know, took care of each other back then, the closeness of them, the diversity was a surprise. I didn't know much about the Métis people. My grandfather told me about them. I remember in the kitchen of their house once, and I think it was important for him to tell me about them. He had a lot of respect for them. And so that kind of planted a seed. And that's where the character of Peter came from.
Tell us about Jimmy O'Brien. And how did you write Jimmy from close range without ever softening the crime?
You know, each chapter generally it follows a person, and in, I guess, the close third person, technically. And I intentionally never gave him his own voice. I thought of him as a sociopath. I added a couple other, you know, crimes to the story. I guess you could call them crimes. Yeah. But apparently he just wasn't a good person, obviously. I'm not really giving anything away. It's in the historical record, and it's not really a spoiler, but he killed his best friend, you know. And there are newspaper stories about him being in Grand Forks and being, you know, disorderly and arrested there. So, in fact, someone who read the book shared that with me. Their great-grandfather was George Roadhouse, who was the sheriff in Cavalier, and he acted as the, the stenographer for this trial.
Tell me about Peter, and forgive me if I mispronounce his name, La Framboise. Am I getting that close there?
I think it's La Frambois.
Okay.
Or La Framboise, probably how North Dakotans would end up saying it.
Like, seems to me like he's one of the book's moral centers.
Yeah, I really wanted him to be. That was very intentional. I think probably the Métis people, they were the first settlers in the general area, which was Red River, you know, from Winnipeg down to Pemina. There were buffalo running around there. They were there, you know, not first, but they were there, I guess, second, you know. So that's a mixture of French and Native American or First Nations, or Scotch and First Nations. And they formed their own group. And so I think they may, in history, in general history, be a little bit shortchanged. So I wanted to bring them back. And I was just fascinated about them. You know, as a kid, I spent a lot of time down by the banks of the Red River in Grand Forks, imagining, you know, I was a quote unquote Indian. That's how I thought of it back then. And so, yeah, I thought he'd be a good person to witness the crime.
The case, without giving too much away, turns on how quickly certainty hardens around innocent men. What were you trying to show?
What I'm trying to show is that human nature is to point fingers at the outsider, you know. So here we have a town full of outsiders, really. And what do they have in common? They live in the same town. They just got there. They're immigrants, you know. It was a new town at that time. But then there were a couple outsiders who were just traveling through. And according to the newspapers, they were, you know, the ones that the town assume did it, you know? And so I think it was really the genius of the Icelandic state's attorney, Magnus Brynjolfsson, by bringing in a detective to you know, really solve the mystery.
What interested you most about the men who slowed down the rush to judgment rather than the opposite, accelerated, wanting justice?
There were a lot of thoughtful people back then, a lot people who lived through hard times and were compassionate. I mean, there still is, obviously, but that comes from my remembering my grandfather and his sense of humanity. You know, he interacted with people. He treated people with respect, and he taught us to think of everyone as an equal, not in a fake religious way or anything, but just down to earth, and that we're all human beings and we should respect each other.
I found your prose to be really measured and restrained, and you allowed suspense to build naturally rather than being overly dramatic. Are there particular authors whose style influences you, or is this more of your personality?
It is my personality, but what I was trying to do is remember the people I knew in Nietzsche, and especially the men. They hardly said anything, you know. Now, like my grandma, she was Irish, and they talked a lot. You know, all the women talked a lot. And so I would kind of, as a kid, get to go back and forth between those worlds, you know. I'd go out with my grandpa. I remember one day he was hauling gravel. And, you know, we didn't talk all day. But I just enjoyed being with him in the truck, you know. People said what they needed to say to communicate. So I wanted to keep it simple. And I thought that's how they would talk during that time. And I didn't have a particular author in mind, you know, but I'm sure it's an amalgamation of a lot of things that I read. And maybe the closest would be like Cormac McCarthy or something like that.
After spending so many years with Arthur LeClaire's story, has writing the novel changed the way you think about North Dakota history?
Oh, absolutely. I didn't know much about it. You know, I didn't really pay attention to history in school very much. I like language and science. So yeah, it changed the way I think about it. I read some of the history of, you know, I think Robinson published a book in 1966 that was a pretty good book about North Dakota history. And I read quite a bit of that. So it changed completely the way I think about North Dakota in terms of the history. I mean, I've always had a love of North Dakota, and, you know, it's part of me and it always will be, even though I haven't lived there for over 40 years.
When did you know, Bill, that the book was done?
Well, I kind of mapped out all the chapters and you know, I'm a scientist, so I like to do things in a structured way. So I mapped out the story in advance, and that allowed me just to write it without thinking about what was coming next. And once, you know, I got to the last chapter, and that was it. You know, I knew it was done. Of course, I had to revise it a lot, but.
What do you hope readers take away after they finish reading A Murder for Christmas? What do you hope stays with them the longest?
Well, I hope they enjoy the mystery, and I hope they feel like they've spent time in Nietzsche in 1907, you know? And probably most of all, I want them to take away that, you know, Arthur and the other people, you know, in the book become human beings rather than just names in an old newspaper.
Can you give us a preview of your next novel, The Glittering World?
It's totally different, and that's based on being, you know, 30 years in the biotech industry, and it's kind of a fast-paced thriller with a lot of science in it. So, yeah, and that the basic story there is that some Some people have revived an old project at Stanford that can change people's gene expression to make them a little bit different. So someone starts a biotech company and they use an mRNA vaccine to deliver kind of a super antidepressant to people. But they've used artificial intelligence to help make that drug. And the artificial AI has done something to it that's a little bit extra. So
you've launched us from 1907 to maybe what, 2035, 2040, Bill?
Yeah, or the way things are moving now, maybe 2027.
Maybe sooner. My guest has been Bill Tronsett. His novel is A Murder for Christmas, inspired by the real 1907 murder of Arthur LeClaire in Nitshe, North Dakota. Drawing on decades of research, family history, and contemporary newspaper accounts, the novel recreates one of North Dakota's most compelling historical crimes while preserving the character of a prairie community that helped shape our state's history. Bill, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Likewise. Thank you very much, Craig. It's been an honor to be on your show.
Still ahead on Main Street, for generations, the Homestead Act was often portrayed as a failed experiment. But Dr. Tom Ezern shares that new scholarship tells a different story, plus tough times on the farm. Many Midwest farmers are facing another year of negative profit margins. Is today's downturn another 80s crisis? That's all still ahead on Main Street, right after this news. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For decades, historians viewed the Homestead Act as a disappointment, an experiment marked by hardship, failure, and unintended consequences. But recent research is challenging that long-held narrative. In this edition of Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Ezern traces the roots of North Dakota's identity, arguing that the combination of immigrant ambition and the homesteading experience created a distinctive culture whose values still resonate across the prairie today.
It says something about me as a historian that I am preoccupied with the origins of things. I mean, I seldom just launch into an abstract investigation into something in the past from which I am disconnected. I begin with a thing here and now and then get curious about the question, well, where did that come from? How did this thing come to be? A thing like, what kind of people we are here in Dakota Territory? Often the ready answer to such a question lies in what theorists like to call sensitive dependence on initial conditions. What were the circumstances of life like for the settler society on the Northern Plains? Likely, those initial conditions set a certain course. Recently, I was asked to hold forth on the subject of homesteading for a gathering at the Welk Homestead in Emmons County, standing, of course, on a homestead, that of Ludwig Welk, proved up in 1902. Looking forward to the appearance, I reflected on what I had learned in college more than a half century ago about the Homestead Act, which was, all the scholars said then, a big mistake. The Homestead Act, they argued, was a failure. Homesteaders had a miserable time on the plains, and most of them failed. Where they succeeded, the effect was to displace indigenous peoples from their homelands and to destroy the native prairie. Besides that, there was a lot of fraud involved, and so the moral legacy of homesteading was shaky all around. Over the past few years, however, a scholar named Richard Edwards and a team of researchers from the University of Nebraska, using the deep documentary resources now available digitally, have overturned the negative appraisal of homesteading with two books, Homesteading the Plains and Great Plains Homesteaders. Edwards declares homesteading, overall, a success, and the source for a catalog of aspirational virtues in prairie society. Modesty, honesty, optimism, spirit of adventure, among others. Two states, Nebraska and North Dakota, led all others in the percentage of land homesteaded, 45%. Now, since most homesteaders also acquired additional lands by preemption or timber claim, this means that most of North Dakota was held by homesteaders, and homesteaders dominated its culture. Now, while I'm slinging academic jargon, though, I'm going to throw in another term of recent origin, intersectionality. As William C. Sherman has informed us with his exhaustive studies, the vast majority of these folk taking up land were immigrants. North Dakota led all states in percentage of foreign-born population. Intersectionality as an idea invites us to consider that the combination of two or more identifiable factors may create something bigger than or distinct in character from any one of them. So consider this intersection, homesteader plus immigrant. What we got was the peculiar attitude of the Northern Plains, at least until recently, that the historian Catherine McNichol Stock has labeled producerism. Producerism is not the same as practical or populist or anything else. It is our thing. It is the respect and regard in which we hold real work and productive labor. It does not disparage intellectual or scientific endeavor. Producerism, though, insists such pursuits should accomplish something, like teaching or healing. And if you work with your hands, more power to you. A century ago, Willa Cather already feared this immigrant homesteader ideal was dead or dying. But not here, not in this radio space, nor will I admit the possibility it is gone. It may, however, be lying fallow.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and the author and presenter of Plains Folk, celebrating the people, places, and traditions that continue to shape life across the Northern Plains.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. For many farmers across the Midwest, the math simply isn't adding up. Corn and soybean prices remain stubbornly low, while production costs continue to climb, leaving many producers wondering whether they'll make money at all this year. Those pressures have prompted inevitable comparisons to the farm crisis of the 1980s, when hundreds of thousands of farms were lost. Harvest Public Media's Hope Kerwin explores what's driving today's financial strain, how it compares to that earlier era, and why experts believe modern safety nets may change the outcome.
In southern Wisconsin, not far from the Illinois border, rows of green corn blanket Pat Malooly's family farm. The sixth-generation grower has had strong yields for both corn and soybeans during the past 2 years. Those abundant harvests have helped make up for low crop prices since 2024. But Malooly worries he won't have that to fall back on this year.
Sitting here today, our crop doesn't appear to be as good as last year.
He's hoping there will be enough at the end of the season to at least cover what he's had to spend to grow the crop. Profit margins for both corn and soybeans have been negative for the past 2 years, according to data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This year's cost of production is projected to be even higher, thanks to the war in Iran driving up the price of fertilizer and fuel. It's far from the first tough financial time Malooly's family has had to navigate. More than four decades ago, farmers faced another period of negative margins. By the end of the 1980s farm crisis, an estimated 300,000 farmers had defaulted on their loans. Malooly was a teenager at the time. He says it wasn't until much later that he understood how much his parents struggled to manage their debt and keep farming.
Horror stories of them not even getting the interest paid, you know, and putting that back on the debt. So it was very tough times back then.
The current struggle for row crop farmers to make a profit feels akin to the 80s. But ag economist Seth Meyer from the University of Missouri says that's where the comparison ends.
I think you just have a different system involved now than you used to have.
In the 80s, growers were forced to sell their farms in order to pay off debts. But Meyer, who was previously USDA's chief economist, says a landslide of foreclosures is unlikely to happen today, thanks to federal safety net programs. More producers use crop insurance, as well as government programs designed to offer financial support when crop prices fall.
I'd also say we've got a government that seems willing to inject a lot of money into the system.
Meyer says one-time aid payments, like the Trump administration's $12 billion assistance program, can help farms pay down their debts and survive until crop prices recover. But he says the influx of cash may also be keeping prices for farm supplies high. At the same time, interest rates have increased from the lows seen during the COVID-19 pandemic. They're still well below the roughly 20% charged by banks in the early 80s.
There weren't long-term fixed interest rates at that time.
Joe Springer is managing director of ag lending for Compeer Financial, working with farms in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And he says most farms are not carrying as much debt.
We're coming off a record years where our row crop producers made more money than maybe they ever had in their careers in the early 2020s here. And so that's different than what happened as we were going through the 80s.
But the profits from 2021 and 2022 are starting to run out. And Springer says farmers will need to think about how they're going to manage more volatility in markets in the coming years. Meyer says the impact of the current downturn will also depend on how much longer crop prices stay depressed.
Does this continue on for several years? In which case, you've already got folks that are trying to get themselves to next year.
In Wisconsin, Mullooly is also thinking about next summer, despite months of work ahead to get to this year's harvest. He's already looking to lock in prices for some supplies, with the hope of guarding against future increases.
Everything we do is managing risk, and there's a cost to that.
He might end up paying too much if the cost of fuel or fertilizer comes down. And it's hard to predict what will happen to crop prices before next season. I'm Hope Kerwin, Harvest Public Media.
Hope Kerwin's report is the first in Tough Times, a new Harvest Public Media series examining the economic challenges facing American agriculture in 2026. Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms throughout the Midwest and Great Plains, reporting on food systems, agriculture, and rural communities.
Capital Shakespeare presents The Two Gentlemen of Verona, a Shakespeare comedy presented in a 1990s setting. Performances are July 22nd through 26th at 7 p.m. outdoors at Bismarck State College near the Sidney J. Lee Auditorium. Folding chairs or blankets are welcome. Free will donations are accepted. Details at capitalshakespeare.org.
Was water a factor in the diarrhea outbreak? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The outbreak of explosive diarrhea occurring in parts of the U.S. has been linked by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to iceberg lettuce supplied to Taco Bell locations in Indiana, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and West Virginia.
The lettuce was contaminated with the parasite Cyclospora, which takes about 2 weeks to incubate. That makes it hard to trace a source, but as Forbes reports, it could be linked to a failure of agricultural systems and food safety.
Close to half of farm irrigation is done with surface water, which can be easily contaminated with organisms like Cyclospora, from human waste, garbage, and leaking sewage and septic systems.
Contamination might come from farm workers who often live in crowded, employer-provided housing with poor sanitation, according to Amy Liebman of the Migrant Clinicians Network, who told Forbes that when workers are in the fields, there are complaints that they're not afforded adequate breaks.
Food safety monitoring may be the bigger problem, and some are pointing to the cuts made last year by the Trump administration, including DOGE, or the Department of Government Efficiency.
Cyclospora was deleted from part of the food safety surveillance program called FoodNet, the CDC's Foodborne Disease Active Surveillance Network, and one expert told Forbes that it could have provided an early warning or hints as to the source of the outbreak.
As many listeners know, the two largest reservoirs in the U.S. are Lake Powell and Lake Mead on the Colorado River, and last week their combined water levels fell to the lowest they have been in 70 years.
The Colorado River Basin had the smallest snowpack on record last winter, and much of the West is in a long-term drought exacerbated by global warming.
Lake Powell is very close to reaching Deadpool, where the reservoir does not have enough water to turn hydroelectric turbines to produce electricity, and what remains in the lake would just sit there, not running down the river to farms and millions of people.
While officials in the seven states in the basin are working on a short-term agreement on how to manage the river's water, they've been unable to agree on how to share cuts to allocations.
Still, efforts are being made to mitigate the shortage. In Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, officials are coming up with a program funded by the Bureau of Reclamation to compensate farmers and ranchers for conserving Colorado River water.
The Metropolitan Water District of Southern California has agreed with the federal government to keep 200,000 acre-feet of water in Lake Mead this year in return for $65 million. And finally, in 2001, President Bill Clinton issued the National Forest Roadless Area Conservation Policy, better known as the Roadless Rule. It prohibited new road construction and commercial logging in designated areas within the national forest system.
Last year, Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins launched the process to rescind the rule, which would remove protection for nearly 59 million acres of wilderness, saying, in part, that the current directive made it difficult to protect forests from wildfire.
The science says otherwise. According to Environment America, roadless areas do not burn at significantly higher rates than other areas of national forests. A study in 2025 found that wildfires in national forests are more likely to start in proximity to roads, and that building more of them could increase human-caused ignitions.
After Rollins announced her intent, more than 500,000 people submitted public comments, of which 99% were in opposition to the plan. Now, Republicans are trying another tactic to repeal the roadless rule by attaching an amendment to the Wildfire Prevention Act, which supports prescribed burns and forest thinning to fight megafires. It's currently stalled in the Senate.
So, what are the consequences of losing the roadless rule? A new study from the University of Washington says plenty, starting with their finding that the rule supports the drinking water supply for 25 million Americans.
Furthermore, their research shows that forested lands provide higher quality water because soil microbes and plant roots filter contaminants before water arrives at treatment facilities. Cleaner water requires less processing, reducing costs for public utilities.
Roads can also harm biodiversity by spreading invasive weeds that are carried on tires and by fragmenting habitats that wildlife rely on. Most roads cross rivers and streams, which require culverts to allow fish to pass, but according to researchers at Michigan State University, they rarely work, which leads to declines in the health of aquatic populations.
More than 4.2 million miles of public roads crisscross the lower 48 states, enough to reach the moon and back nearly nine times, leaving only around 5% of the nation's land roadless.
Another thing researchers say we'd lose if the roadless rule is gone? Quiet. These protected wilderness areas are one of the few places on Earth you don't have to worry about hearing the hum of traffic.
Like what you hear on This Week in Water? We are a nonprofit organization and you can support our work at h2oradio.org. And thank you.
Oh, the places you'll go. Sleepy Hollow Theater and Arts Park in Bismarck presents Seussical Jr. July 9th through the 18th at 8 p.m. with a pre-show by Rising Stars, featuring Dr. Seuss characters, including Horton the Elephant and the Who's of Whoville. Ticket information available at shtap.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
A rather common sight across North Dakota during the summer months is a large hawk with broad wings and a wide, rounded tail soaring high overhead. Although there may be other species, the odds are good that it would be a Swainson's, red-tailed, or ferruginous hawk. These three hawks are of a type referred to as a budio. Budios may be characterized as large hawks with broad wings and wide, rounded tails. They're often observed soaring high overhead in a rather circular fashion. All three species are rather close in size, having a wingspan of around 4 feet or so, and a length around 2 feet, with the ferruginous hawk generally regarded as the largest budio. Their prey items are also similar, largely consisting of small mammals, such as ground squirrels, mice, and rabbits. The red-tailed hawk ranges over much of North America. In North Dakota, they may be observed over much of the state, but probably more frequently north and east of the Missouri River. It's a species of areas with a mixture of native prairie and or cropland with some wooded areas, and typically nests in large trees. As the name indicates, it has a broad and distinctively red tail that is a key characteristic in identification. The Swainson's hawk is named for British naturalist William Swainson. It's a species of western North America and may also be observed over much of the state, particularly in open prairie with a few trees for nesting. Swainson's hawks can be easily distinguished from the other budios by their dark, rusty brown bib or breastband above a light-colored underside. They, too, are often observed high overhead searching for their prey. The ferruginous hawk, Budio regalis, the regal one, is the largest North American hawk. Ferruginous means rust-colored and is a reference to their reddish legs and back. They may be easily identified overhead by their light undersides and reddish-colored thighs, which forms a distinctive rusty red V. Unlike other hawks, ferruginous hawks are known to construct nests on the ground. So be on the lookout for these interesting hawks soaring overhead this summer. I put links to more information on these hawks, along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. Seabirds, like this short-tailed shearwater, spend most of their lives on the open ocean. These birds rarely encounter humans on the high seas, yet they are dying because of our marine debris. Billions of pounds of plastic end up in our global oceans every year. Animals that mistake this pollution for food often die from malnutrition, poisoning, or damage to their digestive systems. In 2025, a study led by researchers at the Ocean Conservancy found that a seabird who consumes just 23 little pieces of plastic, about the same volume as 3 sugar cubes, has a 90% chance of death. The findings also add to growing evidence that rubber is especially dangerous to seabirds. An earlier study of shearwaters and their relatives found that ingesting debris from rubber balloons is 32 times more deadly than hard plastic. We can all make the world a safer place for birds and people by keeping plastic out of our waterways. You can replace single-use plastics with reusable items, join a community cleanup day in your area, or maybe skip the party balloons at your next event. BirdNote has inspired millions of people to take action for birds. Learn more and join us at birdnote.org.
I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 21st. Born in 1897, Carl Ben Eielson grew up in the small town of Hatton, North Dakota. In 1903, the Wright brothers invented and flew the first flying machine. Eielson was fascinated with airplanes since childhood. In 1917, during World War I, Eielson enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Service. By the time he completed flight school, the war was over. Hundreds of military-trained aviators came home, determined to keep flying. Commercial aviation jobs were just a remote idea in the 1920s. Thousands of Army surplus biplanes were auctioned off, enabling the barnstorm era. Daredevil pilots performed thrilling stunts and sold joyrides to the public. Pilots traveled the country and used local farmers' fields and barns for makeshift airstrips, dropping flyers over towns to advertise their arrival and draw paying crowds. Eielson was a barnstorming pilot for 3 years. Then he went to Alaska to teach high school. Seeing the need and potential growth for aviation in Alaska, he started a commercial air service between Fairbanks and the remote interior. He started the first airmail route, which lasted a short time before losing its government contract. Yet he continually envisioned great new possibilities. His aviation skills and achievements became legendary. In 1928, he took Australian-British explorer Sir George Hubert on the first transpolar flight across the Arctic. They also flew over Antarctica, another first. On this date in 1928, pioneer aviator Carl Ben Eielson was honored with a jubilant town-wide homecoming celebration at Hatton following his flight across the Arctic Ocean from Point Barrow to Spitsbergen, Norway. The sky was the limit for Eielson. In November of 1929, he died in a crash during a rescue mission to save crew and cargo from an icebound ship in Siberia. More than 10,000 people traveled to Hatton to attend his funeral and pay him tribute. In 1948, Eielson Air Force Base in Alaska was named in his honor. He received a posthumous North Dakota Rough Rider Award in 1997, the state's highest honor. The Eielson family home at Hatton became a historical museum. The impressive Queen Anne-style residence is evocative of an era and the remarkable North Dakotan who grew up in it. Well worth a visit to Hatton. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lee Serdrick. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Some lawmakers are raising concerns about conditions for people with disabilities in ICE detention. This comes after the family of a double amputee launched a national campaign.
When Riding first got detained, the kids' school teachers kept calling. Why the kids would cry and cry? They had different crying spells. They were sad.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
North Dakota, it's a state of endless skies and boundless possibilities. Hi, I'm Danielle Webster. Whether you're a doctor, scientist, teacher, farmer, tradesperson, or even journalist, the thing I love about this state is you can write your own ticket to a successful career and a happy life. We at Prairie Public want to reflect on this energy as we cover the things that matter to you: education, property taxes, and emerging developments like data centers that could transform the landscape and life here in this vast and beautiful part of the world. From growing up in rural North Dakota to now living in a vibrant and diverse metro area, I want to tell stories that are informative and relatable to people with that shared experience, maybe someone like you. So I hope you'll tune to Prairie Public for the regional news you want to know.
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday's Main Street. Tomorrow on the show, Bluegrass Goes Pink brings music, community, and cancer support to the state of North Dakota. And there's been a venue change this year. The event is headed indoors to the Washburn Memorial Building, and we'll preview what's coming up this weekend. Plus, on Prairie Plates, A Taste of Paris arrives in Fergus Falls. That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.